Hi, I'm Dan Cottrell, editor of Rugby Coach Weekly. You're about to jump into one of our podcasts. If you want to find out more about this podcast and also all of the great content, drills, activities, games and advice on the website, then go over to www.rugbycoachweekly.net. I hope you enjoy the podcast.
Be the best rugby coach you can be. Welcome to Rugby Coach Weekly Podcast with head coach Dan Cottrell, where you learn hints and tips from the rugby coaching community. Let's get started.
Hello and welcome to the Rugby Coach Weekly Podcast with me, Dan Cottrell. I am delighted to welcome to the show Dave Ellis. Welcome to the show, Dave.
Cheers, Dan. Nice to be here, man.
Well, it's fantastic to have Dave along with us. I've been following Dave's work for a very long time. He is very well traveled. If you can see a picture of now, he has got the Connacht flag in the background, but he is at present in Palmerston in New Zealand. So Dave, before we get started, just give us a little bit of background to where you have come from coaching wise and where you are wanting to go perhaps.
Yeah, that's the biggest question out. Coaching for me has been pretty fortunate. I've coached pretty much everything from my four-year-old son to All Blacks in the Super Rugby team. So it's been a long journey. For me, the professional side of it really kicked in with my first big foray over in the UK when I was with Connacht in Ireland with Pat Lamb, and followed up with the Blues back here in Super Rugby in New Zealand. Right now, I've just finished helping out at one of the local high schools with their first 15, who had a very successful season and broke a few records for the school. Where do I want to go from here? Just keep going, I think. You know, like, I'm a bit long in the tooth, but the teeth aren't falling out yet. So okay, I've got a few more miles left on the clock, I reckon.
There's an interesting one that... We look at coaches and some coaches seem impossibly young. I mean, how can you be a coach at 26, 27? Is that, can you be the best version of a coach at that age with all that energy and enthusiasm? Or do you need to have a few more miles under the on the clock?
Jinga, that's a real question there, Dan, because... You know, old guys like me probably like to say that the young guys haven't got a clue because they've not been through the trenches and, you know, had all the difficulties along the way. But I don't know if that's completely 100% true either. I think for me, I love the enthusiasm of the young coaches and I love the way that they can connect well with the teams. But so that's a real tough question because I think you do need some experience. To when the crunch comes down, you know, and you're going through some difficult things. If you've experienced it before, you're kind of halfway to solving the problem. But if it hits you, and it's particularly the coaches who are coaching really high levels when the pressure really comes on, and they get a bit of a hard time from either fans or media or even their team, you know, I feel for them a little bit because sometimes it's just as simple as approaching something or handling something a different way, but because they've never experienced it, they always kind of struggle. But by Christ, I'd give my left arm to have that enthusiasm back again and that spring in my step, you know?
Well, I'm sure you've still got the spring in your step, Dave. It's interesting that you are talking about those experiences, you learn from those experiences. And I'm catching cold here, so... brilliant if you can pull them out of the ether. Can you give me some examples of times when you said, yes, I've really learned from that experience and I've changed the way that I have approached a particular situation?
Yeah, I think, go back to when I was a younger coach, even just coaching club rugby in Australia, actually. I remember little things would bug me, you know, and they'd sit with me for a long time and sometimes a team would suffer for it. But now what I have learned that you just got to move on, you know, and you got to, you know, we tell our players this, but sometimes coaches, we kind of tend to sit on it for a long time and you worry about maybe a phrase that you might have said at training, and you might dwell on that. And many a time I've come home and thought, oh, gee, that wasn't a great training session. It didn't work that well. But my wife's grounded me a couple of times, and she says, yeah, but, you know, some of the people that I'm working with have never seen me before, so they wouldn't know a good session from a bad session anyhow, because they've never seen me. So I guess the things I've learned from experience is to not to hold on to things for too long. You know, work your way through, get your solution, and then move on.
We are sensitive to what people say to us, and that's one of the things that you said, that as a young coach, you're probably very sensitive to it. But there's also times when we can probably be too unsensitive. That's a really hard balance. In terms of that, do you have a sort of in your mind something where you say, these are things which are important? So if I say the wrong thing to this person, I do need to go back in. What's sort of the main areas where you have to be a little bit more sensitive, and where are the other areas where you say, oh, look, just, yeah, let's just get on with it?
Yeah. Well, I think that there's no real definitive answer there, but the thing is, know your people. And that's another thing that I was good at when I was younger, and then I went away from it because I got so wound up in what I was trying to achieve in a session or in a season or whatever, that you forget that you're dealing with people. So I think with that, there's some people you can come down a bit harder on, and some people you have to go a little bit more softly. So I kind of getting back to that, that's probably the biggest thing that I learned when it comes to handling those situations, is know your people. And I think you get through things a lot better.
It's often said, know your people, understand what they're like. And coaches who have been told this don't then do it authentically. They don't approach it in the right way. Is it just something that one does naturally, or do you have to work hard at it?
You have to work hard at it. I'm quite a shy person until I step out on the football field, and then they can't stop me talking, and I'm terrible. But I'm actually quite a shy person, so I struggle asking people the simplest of questions. You know, how many kids have you got? What's your wife's name? Those little wee things. I struggle with those. When we were in Connacht, used to do some really cool stuff about the players would get up and do a video presentation, for example, of themselves, what meant a lot to them, showed us their families and things like that. And I thought that was a really cool way in that environment to get to know people. And I learned all sorts of things from when the players would get up and they'd talk about, I didn't know they had a pet dog called Trixie or whatever, you know, or whatever, you know. And so it was really cool. And so I think that was be a cool way to do things going forward. And I'd probably replicate something very similar to that. As a means of getting to know people and getting myself out there as well. Like I did one of those presentations and put a bit of time in it. You know, it was a video thing, you know, so you'd have photos and bits and pieces like that. And I really thought, well, it made me think about some of the things that the players probably wouldn't know about me, you know, and it was kind of cool.
I like the way that you talk about being quite shy. That doesn't seem to marry up with coaches in general. Do you think that more coaches are shyer than they want to admit to?
Yeah, I think so. Like, it's a different era now too, you know, the bravado is so much under scrutiny these days, you know. So if you were to come across as bigger than Ben Hur, you might, and you're faking it, you're going to get found out, you know, in the way that the world is now. And it's okay to be shy or a little quiet or not the quintessential, that sort of coach is out banging out information all the time, you know. And it's just in the same way, it's okay now for a coach to say, crikey, I don't know how to do that. Let's try and figure that out with the player, you know. So for me, I don't find I think there's more of them out there than we think.
Yeah. Okay. I think that is the case now that in our current situation, you can be a different personality. Whereas before, I think we always expected the coach to be out there shouty and bossing players around. In your introduction, you talked a little bit about the range of players that you've coached. And I think one of the things that coaches often have in their mind is they've got to improve the player. I don't even know why I've said they have in their mind. They want to improve the player. What for you really improves the player? When you look at that player week one and say reflect on them at say week 12, what sort of things are you thinking, yeah, I've made a difference to that? What's changed for them?
I think knowledge. I think if they know why they're doing something, or whether it's a part of the game, a small portion of the game, or even a skill, you know, I think if they know why they're doing it, because a lot of players don't necessarily know why they do something. They know that I have to throw the ball, for example. I know I have to clean a ruck. I know I have to tackle, you know, but there are different sorts of tackles. There are different sorts of passes. There are different sorts of things that breakdowns that they have to do. So if they understand why they're doing something, I think that's, for me, I think, yeah, okay, we're moving in the right direction here, you know. Like if after a 6 or 8 week block and they're still scratching their head and not too sure why they run a certain line, for example, you know, if they don't know that after 6 or 8 weeks, then I'd start to think, crikey, I've taught them nothing, you know.
So you've been working with this high school team. Their age is, 17, 18?
Yeah.
So give me some examples of the things that you've added value to in terms of the why.
I've been primarily the backs coach with these guys. I've come in pretty much halfway through the season with them. A great bunch of kids. But we talked about just simple things like back strikes, you know, for example, and what it's all about and why we do certain things. Now, I'm going to name drop here, Dan, and please forgive me, but it's...
No, you've got some good names to drop, so we'll enjoy this.
It paints a picture of why I think like this now. I was given the reins of the Blues back line for a short time, and I remember running some strike plays with them, and here's the name drop, and Sonny Bill came up to me and he says, who am I picking on here, Dave? You know, as to, you know, what's his job and it made me think. I thought, crikey, good questions, Sonny. And who are you picking on? And then, you know, made me sit back and look at the play that we were trying to put together and the strike that we were trying to put together. And
when Sonny Bill Williams says to you, who am I picking on, what does that mean?
So if it's a multifaceted strike, so you've got more than one or two options, he didn't know who was he targeting and what was he looking for. So if I'm running at you, for example, is he looking for you to turn in or turn out? You know,
right.
You know, is he trying to distract somebody else, you know, by his movement? So it's just that sort of thing. And I now see that side of the game totally different from that day on. Just, it was best thing a player has ever said to me when it came to, just made me think. Because as coaches, we find ourselves thinking what other people want us to think, because, or what some other coach has told us, this is how you think and this is how you plan through things. But for me, our best learnings as coaches comes from the players.
Yep, definitely.
And, you know, if we can ask them the right questions.
And the fact that he came up to you shows that the environment was such that he felt comfortable asking the question. So with the you've got someone like Sonny Bill Williams, who is, I mean, he's an unusual player in a sense, because of course his athletic ability and his handling abilities way beyond what many people can achieve. So you've got an under 17 there, probably aspires to be like Sonny Bill Williams themselves. How can you give them, what sort of questions are you asking them that allow them to get some way, if not all the way, to the sort of the knowledge of a Sonny Bill Williams?
pretty much the very same question, you know, like we'll run some activities, for example, and then I'll say, you know, the question might be about, so who's going to be in front of you, do you think, when this is happening? You know, what's the person opposite you going to be doing? What would you be doing if it was you defending you, for example, you know, or vice versa? So start to get that process going. So I found inadvertently the boys just start to look forward more, look ahead more. They start to, their heads start to come up a little bit. They're not blindly running as they sometimes tend to do, you know. Particularly, I never use the word decoy. I hate the word dummy runner. I detest it. You know, you need to be an option runner, and everybody has to run a correct line to be an option. So once we start talking about what are you looking at, what's going to help, what's happening in front of you, then we start to reduce those wasted decoy runners that we so often see, you know, two meters in front of the ball carrier or running sideways in a direction that nobody really cares about, you know. So those are the sort of questions I do that prompt them and start the thought process going. And then hopefully if the question comes off the back of it from them, that we can answer it together.
I like the word that you've just used, care, that a defender cares about what you're doing, and then that manipulates their actions. Yeah. Now, in terms of picking on or that defender caring about you, you are then, you've got the player to think about it, then they've got to put into some actions. So how do we, once we've, the player understands that they've got to manipulate the defender in some way, how are you going to then progress that player? They now know what they should be doing. What happens next?
Now we've got to give them the how. So the how might just start off with how that running line works, for example. Are they swerving or stepping, you know? Are they pushing off an inside leg or an outside leg when they're changing their weight? Understanding that and how that relates to what somebody opposite you will be doing. So sometimes I'll cheat and I'll actually tell the defender or the opposition what to do, unbeknownst to my guy who I'm working with, you know, and I'll try and create pictures that become familiar to the person I'm working with or the group I'm working with. So they're familiar to seeing that picture. So whether it's live or whether it's, and sometimes I might actually just bring in footage of, particularly if it's an opposition that we're playing, we might bring in footage to get some familiarity. But with the 17-year-olds, for example, we'll just tee up situations that replicate the game as quickly as or as closely as we can. Or even if it's just a portion of the game, it might be just what lives within that player's space, for example. If I know that he has to make a decision with two people coming down in his space, then he needs to be able to see what those pictures are. And then I might be able to tinker with the defense a little bit, usually with hand signals or colored cards, which a lot of people know I use, to try and just create a mismatch or a break that he can search for. So that familiarity, from familiarity, then hopefully habits will be formed, or positive habits will be formed.
So with your...
Long-winded.
No. I'm just thinking now that a coach is working, say, with a team. So they've got maybe 15, 20 players at a training session. I mean, if you're lucky, you have more, you have lots of coaches. But let's say we aren't in that sort of professional set up, and you've got taken off the backs, right, Dave? Off you go with the backs. So you may have got your 10 backs with you. How are you setting up? Give me an example of how this sets up. So it runs so players are engaged, because there's nothing worse than players standing around for ages, nothing happening. Yeah. There's a coaching craft in saying, I know what I want the players to be doing in terms of we want to get some running lines. How do we do this practically that makes sense to the players and they don't get caught?
Yeah. Straight into, we start off with a bit of fun usually, which is a one-on-one. Nothing the boys like more than trying to beat their mate in a simple one-on-one scenario. And you can roll those over pretty quickly, you know, through a team quite easily. It's particularly easy with, you know, a back line and a few extras. You know, it's really easy to do just simple one-on-one. 2-on-1, 3-on-1, 3-on-2 activities. Do a lot of that sort of stuff. A sevens activity of defending the line where everybody's always busy. There's nowhere for people to hide. I do a very small portion of it would be my strikes, where a strike plays. Unfortunately, the way the game is these days, backs very rarely get an opportunity where it's just one back line against another, from a scrum, you know. So we spend a little bit of time on that, but we'll do more activities that are more intense, but in maybe shorter spaces, but highlight things like running an unders line or bouncing out to take a ball, or what a simple switch move looks like, and what you're doing when you're doing a switch move, for example. So those sort of activities.
You're listening to a Rugby Coach Weekly podcast. This is part of the rugbycoachweekly.net website. If you click on the rugbycoachweekly.net link, you will find out more about this podcast, but also find access to over 3,000 pieces of content covering drills, activities, games, coaching advice, and lots more to help you and your team with your rugby and your rugby coaching. So why not pop over to rugbycoachweekly.net to find out more and access all this amazing content. In the meantime, back to the podcast. I'm going to just drill into a little bit of detail then on that. First of all, coaches have been running 2v1s since the beginning of time, probably for a long time now. What sort of things do you see go wrong with 2v1s when you see a coach putting together and say, look, that's a 2v1, but it's not going to give the players the right sort of cues? So what sort of things do you do which actually makes it worthwhile for the players, and things that you avoid?
The biggest thing is squaring up. So often in a 2v1, what we'll see is the person with the ball, if there's two players standing here and one guy's over there, the first guy, he just runs wide with the ball, and then he tries to maybe throw the ball back into his mate, which will often work. But it's not really how the game's often played. Like, we're not going to often have that space when it comes to reality. But so I want my first guy to carry hard and close and go straight. So if he goes straight, this guy gets width. 2v1 should always work. Comes down to the nous and the smarts of the defender, if he can anticipate, or if he... But he has to make a decision. He either turns a shoulder in or turns a shoulder out. But if we drift across, so the thing I have the biggest hassle with is if the first man carries and runs lateral and just pushes all the space away from his buddy. So I usually give them fairly limited space anyhow. I say me. This has been done, as you said, for gazillions of years, you know, like everybody does it. And we all do it in a very similar way. But I become a real stickler on the squaring up side of it. Try to run straight, square up. Pat had a saying when we were with Connick, you know, square up, pick them off. So we just pick them off.
Right. Now, these are very game-related scenarios.
Yeah.
What happens if the players, or where do you look at the players almost, and I'm saying it with worried, because there's various debates over what is technique, what is skill. But if they can't pass effectively, at what stage are you trying to make them be able to pass off left hand, right hand, the sort of distances you want to do? Where does that fit in?
That would fit in prior to everything else. So handling is massive. I did a 10-week session with Bristol pre-COVID. So it must be, what, two seasons ago, maybe?
Yeah.
And that's all Pat got me over for, passing. So all we did was catch pass for the whole time I was there, 8 or 10 weeks, I think it was. So vital. And some will get it easy in some way, and some have natural ability and some don't. And it's just a matter of finding a situation which doesn't overcook them by being obsessively technical, because if somebody was obsessively technical, they would have told Sonny Bill years ago, don't throw that ball out of the hand with one, then you're like that, you know what I mean? So you've got to be, you know, aware of what their abilities are, and then just kind of break everything right down and make it as simple as possible. And I like to use simple terms, you know, really. So, you know, at the end of the day, the whole game is about 15 guys have a ball and trying to put it across a line, and there's 15 guys trying to stop them. At the end of the day, that's what the game is. So I try and keep everything in those simple terms. So if I'm talking about finishing to the target with their passing hand, for example, then I'll give them examples of it, and then we can film that, and then we can analyze it, and we can just talk about it. And there's physical barriers you can set up to do that as well. If you're not gifted with video or anything like that, it's not too hard to have a pole standing beside somebody, and they soon fly their hand back, they hit that pole, they soon realize that, crikey, maybe I should get my hand more to the target. So I'm into that sort of stuff, you know, the little quirky things.
When you're working with a team like Bristol, you've got some extremely talented players. How can you add value to someone who's passing extremely well? So I don't know if Semin Andrada was there when you were there pre-COVID, or maybe Charles Pirtau, but these guys are the top of the top in terms of their handling skills. They obviously want to get better. What sort of things are you adding value to someone who's already passing well? What's the sort of little details? I'm asking as a complete geek, skills geek on this.
Pressure, I think. So we would implement all sorts of pressure. We did a lot of little kind of juggling passing type activities with the boys, but not necessarily juggling like this. It was, you know, moving balls around from different scenarios like that. And the pressure was not physical pressure. The pressure just came from speed and accuracy and consistency. And so even the best players will throw a bad pass. If they're throwing 30 balls in like 20 seconds, you know, something's going to go wrong, you know. So it's about trying to eliminate that and trying to press them with young kids, for example. You'd push them but wouldn't break them. It's a bit different for the pros, and for the real top level pros, you can push them and actually break them. And if you break them, they'll catch up and they'll learn really quick. You know, I'd never do that to a kid, for example, because you lose them forever. But the pros, they love it, and the better the player, the more they want you to challenge them. Another story about Sonny Bill I can give you too is I brought juggling into the Blues when I was there, just with rugby balls, like three rugby balls and things like that. And I said to the boys straight up, look, I can't juggle, fellas. You know, I can't juggle tennis balls or anything like the see on TV. Well, bugger me days, Sonny went back, got on YouTube, learned to juggle, came back, and about a week later, he's thinking junker than three or four balls, just like that, you know. And I'm like, hey, it's just, you know, you can't beat that. But that was that same sort of thing as what you're doing with your passing or any other skill. If you challenge the real good guys, they'll rise above it because they just get pushed, you know.
I was with a school yesterday, and I was able to watch quite a lot of the different age groups. And what I saw was that maybe with the B's and C's, their handling wasn't very good. And in my mind, I was thinking, what can I help them with, which will give them some easy wins early on? Because catching is a massive issue in the game for younger players, because if you can't catch the ball, the game's not going to flow for you as a team. So you when you come to any situation really where the players need to catch better, what's the sort of key areas that you look to encourage the players to do a bit more?
Like things like technical things like fingers to the ball and all that sort of stuff.
Well, anything where I'm going to just, I've got some ideas, but if you went into a group of players and you can see, well, these guys are struggling to catch, where'd you go to first? start the system?
Well, I want to start with first, and this is particularly, it works. Look, I unashamedly do little kids' drills on big guys if I have to. So we'll start off with a simple hand the ball race where we might be in a line. Competition is what everybody loves, no matter what level, I think, in nearly every team sport, really. So we'll start off with a simple hand the ball along the line race where there's no pass involved at all. You're simply handing it to your mate straight across as quick as you can. Hand, bring it back. Guy, first team wins, you get a chocolate fish or something. You know, I don't know. So, you know, you might have a bit of competition on that, and then everybody's quite comfortable. Then you might just open the space up a little bit more. Still only a little bit, so the pass is still quite small. Again, have the race. Bit of banter starts happening now. Somebody might drop it. There might be a bit of a yahoo or something like that, but you're just, nobody's moving, nobody's running, still in the line. You just increase that width until they are basically passing. And then when it comes to the catching side of it, we can talk about making sure that they, now that they've got a little bit of a distance, it's all about getting your hands up nice and early. So you might have a simple activity where that the first guy will not move the ball unless everybody's got their hands up. You know, person who hasn't got his hands up, he has to run around the back and start again or something. You know, just little wee things to challenge the whole time, because all I want to get across is the point that you've got to have your hands up before you leave. You know, so I've done things like that. Some of them I'll be straight up with you. I'll just pull them out of my head at the time. Mm-hmm. Not pre-planned, not on my session plan at all. But, you know. I think there's a line from that animated robots movie was, I think, see a problem, fix a problem. I think that's one of the my sons used to watch that when they were little kids. So
yeah,
you know, that's how I kind of operate when it comes to that sort of thing. And you know, you'll find some things will work and some things won't, but eventually you'll have a little kit bag of things that you know usually work.
So we got the skills, and you were talking a bit earlier about working with this back line. One of the struggles is to improve game awareness on the training field. Now, if you're very lucky, as we talked a bit earlier on, you've got a lot of video and you can play that back. But not everyone's got that facility. But also, actually, for many coaches and players, rugby is not their main job. They do think about it a lot, but they don't have the hours to sit down. So you're onto the training field. You've been very keen to talk about the why. How do you improve that game awareness on the training field?
Good question. I think, you know, usually what we do is create some sort of scenarios. Like I was recently in San Francisco. I worked with a schoolboys there as well. For about 3 months, and game awareness was something that some had, but most didn't. You know, they didn't fully understand what we were doing. So when we structured anything, there was always a discussion about it. And the discussion was always about, it harkens back to how I worked with the backs. It's kind of, okay, what are we doing this for? What do you think we're doing this for? And usually the hands will go up because you're telling us to, coach. That's why we're doing it. Yeah, but then we I try to keep everything in context, even if we're doing something that seems a little odd to the players, you know, like the juggling thing, for example. Well, why are we juggling, coach? You know, and then it might be just to sharpen up our hand and hand-eye coordination or something like that. But I try and always bring that back to the relevance. But I'm not claiming that this is definitely not anything new or revolutionary, but I just ask them lots of questions. You know, this, why are we doing this? Why do you think we're doing it? I know the answer, but I'll try to get it from them as much as I can. And if then they need me to help, we will. But my training sessions, on saying that, it sounds like there's a lot of talking going on, doesn't it? But I try to have as little talking as possible. So for me, if I'm working with a group that I know I'm going to be with for a long time, my pre-season is vital, because that's when all the talking's done and the instructions and the detail is put in there, and then it grows from there. And I find And the other thing that I find really helps, and I learned this from another really successful coach too, is having vocabulary that the players can relate to. So by that I mean having words that you use constantly that directly give a meaningful instruction. You know, hands up is a meaningful instruction. Don't run around with your hands flapping around, Fred, is not a meaningful instruction. Mm. You know, meaningful instructions can be run straight, get your hips around, you know. Hands to the ball, you know, finish to your target, you know, body height down, you know, touch the grass before you clean that. Things, those are meaningful instructions. So having a good vocabulary, and what I've found out too, in some countries, the vocabulary doesn't translate. You know, like I go to Argentina and I talk about something and they all look at me in broken English, what the heck are you talking about, you know? I find, a meaningful vocabulary can help players learn the game, because your vocabulary always relates to things that are relevant to the game. And then by always pointing out, even if there is no opposition, often at trainings you haven't got enough bodies to have an opposition or a meaningful opposition. Well, then I found when some work I did here in Palmerston North, we have an indoor area and there's a massive big wall down one side of it. And I think that makes a pretty good opposition. So if you haven't got rid of the pass, the last guy hasn't got the ball in his hand, by the time you get to the wall, somebody's going to get hurt.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, always talking about width, depth, timing, spacing, even if it's imaginary, because, you know, you might not have the luxury of opposition. And the game then is there for them to then learn from that, because if they understand depth, they understand width, understand timing, how much time they need to do something, That's a massive part of the game there. And you can do that in meaningful ways at trainings that not every time will fall straight into the game, but at least you've planted that seed with young players anyhow. So it'll grow with them as they learn the game more through experience.
You talked a bit about width and depth there and squaring up. In a situation where a team, say, has a 5v4 or a 6v4, the first player who has the ball in his hands, his or her hands, how are they able to fix the first player? Because by the time the third pass has come along, the person who was opposite the player who made the first pass must have drifted off by then, drifted over. So this seems to me like a massive challenge, because a 2v1 is very obvious. It's very easy to understand how to fix a player, stay square. But in a 6v4, that first player, they can't take the ball right to the line. That's impossible. So how do we help them understand what's going on? Because maybe it's 6v4s or 5v4s are impossible to execute to create that 2v1 on the end. What are you thinking that players should be doing? How should they be approaching this?
That's the million-dollar question. I think every coach would like the answer to that one. But
okay, well, there we are. This is now being asked and will now be revealed. Dave Ellis knows the answer. Yeah. In fact, before you go into that, the answer is, to a certain extent, don't think that you're going to execute a 5v4 with beating a player on the end. That's not going to happen a lot of the time. Is that what we're suggesting?
No, not for me. Not for me. I think if we got a 6v4, I'd like us to think that we can get that guy away at the end. Somebody has to square up or somebody has to run a holding line. I think being flatter and being more aggressive in our carries gives us a greater chance. We played against a side recently who had a very good back line, but I observed when I looked at the footage of them that they were very deep. And because they tried to engage us and they had that very same problem that you're just talking about here, because they tried to engage us and they thought, well, we'll engage them, but we'll hold some depth. Well, that second guy, they never really challenged us. So they might challenge the first guy or the second guy, but because there was so much depth, we had so much more recovery time to get in their face. But if they were flatter against us, ran more aggressively and had quicker hand speed, they probably would have got around us a few times, because remember, we're at the moment, we're probably followed a lot of UK rugby, so most teams here now will defend on the outside shoulder, where New Zealand was mostly an up, inside, out type defensive team. You know, so, but we can just keep fairly square and run aggressively and be quite, hand speed makes a massive difference. For me, I remember years ago when the All Blacks, I don't think the guys will mind me talking about this, but years ago when the All Blacks first started to go with their flat attack, and I think the first time we did it was against the Springboks, and they absolutely pummeled the heck out of us. And I think what it was because we didn't have the passing capability to be able to shift the ball quickly in a flat space and get to that outside. So, Dan, you know, like the Eller brothers from many years ago, the Wallabies, the best passing team in the world, in my opinion. Yeah. They challenged the line. They had depth in those days because the game was slightly different. The defences were different. But by crikey, they moved that ball really quickly along that line and gave their wingers all that time and space on the end. So I think, for me, yeah, you still have to engage that first guy. You're not going to be running right into his pocket, obviously. But then it's the matter that the people who are flat still hold their line a little bit too, hold their depth in such a way that they don't just leave at the same time. And so it's our departure time is what we often need to work on. If we're flat, we're a threat. You know, if we're deep, we're not a threat. If we're flat and we can learn to hold our departure time, we've got a good chance that we can still keep everybody engaged. Does that kind of make sense?
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I think in the very old days, used to say your depth, you take your depth by being able to see the number on the back of the shirt of the player you're next to. And I think that's gone.
Not completely.
Not completely. But you need to be. You do need to be able to, as you say, time your run off the player inside you. And that's absolutely the key. And going back to something you said earlier about who am I picking on, the player in front of you's got to be engaged. I mean, working with players who are quite talented but have not got much game awareness on wingers, I think I saw a game I was involved in a few weeks ago. Nothing, we hadn't spent any time with them on this part of the game. And the winger was probably 30, 40 metres from the game line.
Yeah.
And it just doesn't make sense that they should be that far back. Now, the hard thing is you're saying you've got to be able to run aggressive lines and be flat.
Yeah.
Now, there is a lot of conflict there for a player to be able to get that speed up and be able to be flat.
Yeah. Yeah.
How there is. Do you help that player through that conflict?
I think it's a little bit of that departure time, as I mentioned before. Then when do you go? You know, when do you leave to have, so you've got your speed onto the ball? You need to have enough speed on the ball to be a threat, but not too much speed on the ball that you can't throw it. You know, you can't move it quickly. I talk a lot about body height for my passes, particularly my inside backs, probably out 10, 12, sometimes 13, where they should be more over that ball. Their feet need to be under them. They need to be in a strong position should they be forced into contract, should they get their timing wrong. But also by being over, their hips are locked a little bit more, which is going to keep them squarer. They've got a greater ability to move that ball smoothly through their body as opposed to around their body, which a lot of them will do. And I talk a lot about that. So that engagement will come from that sort of speed, because our feet are under us the whole time. So we're forever tuning over, as opposed to the long loafy strides, I guess. So,
I mean,
it's not coming out of my mouth.
Yeah. So I'm thinking there about how you can help a player to be leaning forward to pass the ball. They've got to have that sensation, even if they're not necessarily completely leaning forward. And we're saying this given that players are all sorts of different heights and body shapes.
Yep.
But if they can feel that they're leaning forward, perhaps, is that going to give them that better opportunity to pass a little bit more efficiently, keep square?
Definitely. And your feet are under you. So should an opportunity arise or a threat come into your space, your feet are under you, you can move. You know, so you can step, you can slide, your feet are under you, and they're short and you can move. We're low and loafing. I'll tell you one of my secrets. It's not really a secret because I've shown anybody who asked me, really. But get your players out next time you go down with them, if there's an issue here. Get them all to have a rugby ball. I can't believe that I'm in a room here. I've got a house full of
You've got every sort of paraphernalia to do with rugby, but a rugby ball in there.
Yeah, exactly. So get them to stand with a rugby ball in front of them.
Yeah.
Okay. Just holding it in two hands like this. Get them to stand as tall as they possibly can. So bolt upright. And tell them and get them, and you stand maybe 20 meters away and tell them to run to you as fast as they possibly can. So they're all spread out with a ball. Swing that ball as hard as they possibly can and run past you. Get them to do that. Listen to their feedback. And then take them back after that and say, okay, now I want you to do exactly the same activity, but this time you're going to lean forward until you're almost falling over, like you're. Feel the weight coming through your toes, and you're going to say you're bent right over, and you've got to do the same thing, swinging the ball as hard as you can, and then ask them the feedback on that. And I guarantee the feedback you'll get will be, the first time my hips and my shoulders were going all over the place, I couldn't control it. Second time, when their feet are under them, they've got balance and they keep square and they can run straight. And I just do that with kids. I do that with anybody. And it's like a light bulb moment. And then I don't have to talk about it much after that. It comes down to my vocabulary, my language, body over the ball, feet under you. And that's why.
I love that. And obviously this podcast is coming out in a week or so's time. But any player who's meeting me in the next week, this is what I'll be doing. To test that. Dave, that's brilliant. I'm going to finish on that absolute gold, because we've covered a whole range of topics. Really enjoyed getting your insight. Really enjoyed catching up with you. Can you tell us a little bit about there's some things coming up you're going to be doing with some skills camps and things? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, hopefully. I'm trying to get a skills camp going here. It's quite a costly venture because of the facility that I'm using. Mm-hmm. But what we're trying to do is we're trying to look at skills slightly differently. So that's a camp for 16 to 18-year-olds and kind of really focusing on this. Because what happens, we've discovered, is lots of the courses that you see out there and others that I've been involved in as well, we don't often have the time to really give that why that we talked about for a skill. You know, we tend to follow on through it and then we move on to something else or whatever. So what we want to do in this, it's a 4-day camp, live-in camp, and a little bit of team building, but mostly it's all skills, which the players will be filmed. So we'll film them. If I can get the budget, we'll film them from multiple angles. But initially it might just be me on my iPad, which I've used in the past. So we'll film them through these tests that I've designed and kind of that cover catch, pass, tackle, ball into contact, decision-making around all these areas, etc. They'll be filmed. Then we'll go back in after the film session and we'll do a little bit of theory. So we'll talk to the players about what do they think, what were they doing out there in their tests, because the tests they will do totally blind. There's going to be no information coming in. You're just going to follow the instructions. Then we'll talk about what they understand and what they believe they should be doing. And then we'll kind of deliver some scenarios or some tactical situations that certain different passes might be used in, or different ball carry techniques. And then we'll go out and we'll run a series of activities that highlight things like running square, things like being over the ball, long pass, short pass, backdoor pass, all those sorts of things. We'll do a series of activities in there. And then we'll also, then at the end of the day, we'll pop up their video and we'll, in the group scenario, we'll talk about the video, see what they now they know what they were, what do they see now when they're looking at their video. And then at the end of the course, I'll go away with the video that I'll edit and put little highlight thingies on and make it a little bit was bangery, and a series of notes on what we did and how we did it and any corrections that they might have, which is the customary things like elbows are up or legs are this way or, you know, backs are bent like that. So highlight all those things, give them some work-ons, and then they're just free to off they go back into the rugby world and knowing that they can just give me a buzz anytime they like if they want to keep me updated.
Yes, it sounds like a course I'd like to come on if I was only significantly younger than I am today. And Dave, how do people get in contact with you?
Through my website, so ellisrugby.co.nz. That's probably the easiest way.
Right.
All my details are on there. So.
Right, brilliant. Well, I'll put a link into that in the show notes and link to the course as well. So, Dave, it's been absolutely brilliant catching up with you. Loads of insights, some really good and golden tips to take away, two or three ones which I'll be using absolutely immediately. And I'll be surprised if our coaches who are listening in won't be using them either. So that's brilliant. Thank you very much for your time.
Not a problem, Dan. My pleasure. Maybe I'll get over your part of the world again one day. It'd be nice.
Well, I think that a lot of people are wishing that you were able to come and maybe run some courses over here. So let's keep our fingers crossed for that. That would be brilliant. Okay, so thank you very much, everyone, for listening. This is rugbycoachweekly.net podcast. If you go over to the website, as I said, rugbycoachweekly.net, click on the podcast button, you can find more about this podcast and all the other podcasts that we do. So thanks again to Dave, and thanks to everyone for listening, and hope to catch up with everyone very soon.
Thanks for listening to Rugby Coach Weekly Podcast. If you want to hear more podcasts, head over to rugbycoachweekly.net and click on the blogs tab to catch up on any episodes you've missed. We look forward to speaking to you again soon with more insights from coaches and experts from the world of rugby, sport, and learning.